Okay, so here's a question. Who here has filed their tax return already? Wait.
For what year?
How? I just want to point out, seniors, that it is Jen and Margie and Sharon who have raised their hand for this one. Get it together, people. No. I want to propose a little thought experiment here. What if the IRS required, in addition to your W-2s and your 1099s and whatever other forms you have to send to them when you fill out your tax return, what if the IRS required that you include a brief personal statement about your family of origin? Okay, so I was trying to work on mine here. I think I got to read it because I had to do a little research. Here's, for example, I would have to write something like this. I am the descendant of people who came to this country as religious refugees almost 250 years ago. These people purchased land from their fellow Quaker, William Penn, who had been granted that land by King Charles II in payment of a large debt that King Charles II owed to William Penn's father, who had been an admiral and a sea captain. Charles II, in turn, had in large part stolen this land from the Lenape tribe. Other members of my family came as economic refugees from Ireland about 100 years ago. They found work in factories, copper smelting plants, and groceries. It took a generation before they were able to buy property. I come from people who have struggled and sacrificed. I come from people who experienced deep poverty and people who were displaced from their homeland. And so it is with deep gratitude that I now return to you, Internal Revenue Service, a portion of the wealth that I mistakenly refer to as my own. What do you think? What would your personal statement say? I was imagining a service now where we would all go and write this and read it to each other. I mean, I think that would be a really interesting exercise. May I suggest that you do that over lunch, perhaps? What is it? What is your story? Not just your human personal story, but the story of your people. If you were to remember that story, how would it affect you? Would it make you feel more generous? Would it make you feel more sympathetic to people who now, in this current moment, share some aspect of the story of your ancestors? Huh? Well, there are large parts of the Hebrew Scriptures, of the Old Testament, that are instructions about how the Hebrew people should behave in the context of the temple in Jerusalem. They are ritual instructions about things that should be done there at that temple. And that temple has not existed for 2,000 years. And so these instructions are no longer, nobody does these things, Jews or Christians. So it is very easy to sort of have your eyes kind of blur over when you get to those parts of the scripture. But some of those parts are not just ritualistic instructions. They're ethical instructions. And that's the case with that passage that Carol just read so beautifully from Deuteronomy. This is a ritual prescription. This is something that you're supposed to do when you're bringing an offering. There is a litany that you are supposed to recite. There are words that you're supposed to memorize and repeat as you hand the offering of your first fruits over at the temple. But the words that you say begin with a phrase, "My ancestor was a wandering Aramean, and my ancestors were aliens in Egypt." So in other words, the Hebrew people are supposed to identify first with Abraham, the wandering Aramean, and identify as well with the Israelites, who were, of course, held in captivity under Pharaoh in Egypt. I'm supposed to remember that part of their story. And they're supposed to remember it at the point when they are bringing their offering of first fruits. So at the very moment when they are supposed to feel the most self-sufficient, right? Look what I grew. Look what I produced. I did it myself. No more manna falling from the sky. No more dependence on God for my daily sustenance. Look what I did. I grew stuff, right? At that moment, when you're offering what the first fruits of that work, you say, wait a minute, I didn't always own land. I didn't always have the ability to take care of myself. I wasn't always free to do what I wanted to do. I wasn't always able to receive myself the fruits of my own labor. And when I remember that at this moment, something in me changes. I connect my story to the story of people who are different from where I am right now in my life. And that's the basis of the ethical system in the Hebrew Scriptures, the ethics that Jesus developed in his life and his teachings, the ethics that are at the heart of this community. And we sometimes think of those ethics as built on laws, built on commandments. But behind those laws, behind those commandments, there is something that happens in the heart. It's a heart experience. It's an identification of my story with your story. It's a sense of forging connection between where I'm at in my life and where you are in your life. A sense of solidarity with the suffering of others, with the situation of others. Connection, solidarity, identification is the heart of biblical ethics, heart of Christian ethics. And inversely, disconnection, alienation, is at the heart of what happens to undermine our ethical behavior, our ethical system, our relationships with each other. Because as soon as I say, I am different from you, I have nothing to do with you, you are a different kind of creature than people like me, you are incomprehensible to me, you are alien to me, you are disconnected from me. As soon as I start that way of thinking, I make you into somebody who I can hurt, because you don't matter like I matter, right? That's the beginning of the end of love, disconnection. So at this sort of season in our year, season in our life together, the beginning of Lent, when we have like the sort of nudge to take some stock of where we're at in our life, spiritually, morally, there's one way to check in. Do I connect myself with other people? Or do I seek to disconnect? Do I identify with the struggles of others? Or do I seek to distinguish myself from others? It's kind of interesting question to ask in theory and an uncomfortable question to ask in actual practice, because it's so easy to fall into that disconnecting. I don't know if you've found it, but I feel like the presidential season, the presidential campaign season, is one of continual temptation to do this. Last night, sitting around a table, I can't tell you how many of these conversations I've been in the last 2 months, where everybody in the room agreed that there was some other group of people in this country who were stupid or crazy or, as the conversation went last night, just plain mean. And that group of people obviously are in control of, you know, this campaign process. And they are different than the rest of us. What happened in that conversation? Does that build peace? Does that build a sense of the kind of community and country I want to be in? I'll tell you, it sure felt good. It felt good. But it undermined what I know to be the basis of the way I want to be in this world. And it turns out, you know, this temptation that I experienced last night, that I have a feeling each of you have experienced, maybe even this morning already, that seems to be at the core of the temptation that Jesus had. That's such an odd thought. I mean, there's this sort of fanciful series of temptations that Luke describes, where, you know, the devil points out to Jesus that he could, what's it, turn a stone into bread, that he could get instantaneous admiration from all of the people of the world, if he could jump off of a spire and an angel would rescue him. Such odd series of temptations, and that's certainly nothing I've ever been tempted to do. I mean, no one here, I don't think, has ever been tempted to turn stone into bread. I mean, we might have wished it, but, you know. But at the heart of those temptations, when you look at it, it seems to me that at the heart of those temptations is really this same temptation I experienced at that table last night, because there's this invitation to Jesus to do something spectacularly different than what any human being could do, right? To use his superpowers in some way, to become clearly and forcefully an agent of God in this world, so that everybody could see that and everybody would recognize that. And Jesus refuses. He won't do it. He won't do something that so dramatically would distinguish him, which would differentiate himself from anyone else. And when you hear that, then you hear the echo of that same temptation coming to him throughout his life. There he is on the cross in the Gospel of Matthew. The scribes and the people who gather around say, "Oh, he saved others, but he cannot save himself." Remember this part? And they say, "Let him come down from the cross, and then we will believe in him. Then we will follow him." A temptation that pursued Jesus even to the end. Do something different than us. Be different. Differentiate yourself. Distinguish yourself. Then we can believe in you. And he refuses. And he says, "My way and my will is solidarity with you, identification with you, connection with you, and I will do nothing to break that connection. Because that connection is the beginning of the way that I invite you to follow." Yeah, so now we have this 40-day nudge, this 40-day prompt to take that walk with Jesus a little more seriously. How do we do it? Well, this worship task group, actually the February and the March worship task groups, came together and felt this nudge to focus on peace for these 40 days. And as soon as we started thinking about how that might play out in the course of Lent, we knew that we needed to pray for peace as a community together. There's some opportunities coming up this week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, short gatherings for prayer here in this community. I hope you'll take a look at that. Individually, Jerry's going to talk a little bit more about that. Could we each make a commitment to pray for peace every day from now until Easter? What would happen if we did that? But we knew when the worship task group started talking, and Neil was a good prompter on this, we knew that we couldn't just say, okay, well, we're into peace, then let's pray for peace for 40 days. We knew that it couldn't just end there, that peace isn't just something that we would hold out as an intention, that it is something we would have to do. It's something that we need to act on, find some way to engage in our own life. And what would that look like? I mean, none of us sitting around that table were negotiating international peace accords. You know, what the heck can we do? You know, we don't have a radio talk show. We don't have what are we going to do? And it was really Neil who pushed us to notice that connection and disconnection is a daily choice for each of us. And so that for each of us, sometime this season, we could ask, who am I disconnected from? Who do I feel alienated from? Where is that sense of fracture or difference starting to pervade, starting to invade my life and my heart? And how might I address that? Is there someone I could talk to? Is there someone I could listen to? Is there somebody who I could think about, hold up? Is there a name I could learn? Is there a picture I could find so I could see, put it on my refrigerator, and identify, connect with that issue, that person, that place, whatever it is that has somehow become so different from who I am and what I'm about? I don't know what that looks like for you. And to be honest, even though we started talking about it a month ago, I am not sure what it looks like for me. But we thought we would take some time now at tables to engage this question. Is there something that you are feeling nudged around connection and disconnection, identification versus distinguishing and alienation? And maybe one place to begin the conversation is to say, where does that fracture show up most clearly in my life? Is it somebody in my family? Is it somebody in this country? Some group of people in the world? An ideology, a religion, a nationality, or whatever it is? So first, think of where that disconnection is showing up, and then maybe brainstorm one small thing, one big thing, that you could do over the next 6 weeks to make that disconnection, to chip away at it a little bit, to erode it, to find some way to replace that with something else, something in your heart that builds the way to peace. Let's take a little time now to talk at tables about that. You may not come up with the answer right now, and that's okay. But maybe the people at your table can help you brainstorm a little bit. We'll do this together for a little while, and then we'll check back in.